Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Rebecca Carroll. Melissa Clark has been a staple for lovers of her Wednesday New York Times column, A Good Appetite, and the companion weekly cooking videos. She's also published a ton of cookbooks, but now she's culled 100 of her go-to recipes in one book for Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers. It's called Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. They're for family meals, festive gatherings, and everything in between, and I am delighted that she's here to share them with us. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me about how you culled the recipes, your favorites. Like, how did you choose?
You know, I never really follow my own recipes. I'm constantly going to the new thing, but these are recipes that my family asks for, or these are the ones that are good enough that I'm like, all right, you know, if I make them according to how I wrote them, because I'm constantly like, you know, I'm not a recipe follower, my own recipes or anyone's recipes. I'm always fiddling. And I know that if I make any of these, even if I fiddle with them, if I didn't, I'd still be really happy. And that to me is the ultimate test.
So if you're not a recipe maker or follower, how do you even make one?
Well, you know, a lot of the way I cook is by feel. I love to start, you know, I'll start with an ingredient and I'll kind of go through the fridge and see what's there and put things together. And it's really, you know, it's as I'm cooking, I'm constantly changing. And the thing about a recipe is that a recipe doesn't change. You know, it's right. You follow it from point A to point B. And I can't do that. Like, as I'm cooking, I'm thinking, well, why did I write it like that? You know, for many of my recipes, you know, even if they're good, I'm still thinking, well, but if I turn the heat up, this is low heat, but if I turn the heat up, I'll get more color. And right now in this moment, I want caramelization instead of soft onions or whatever it is. You know, I'm just always changing my mind. And that drive, it really does drive my husband crazy when he loves something. Because, like, you know, that time that you made it according to your recipe.
Could you just make it that way?
Exactly. Can you just do it the way you wrote it? And so these are the recipes that I will do the way, you know, when requested, I will do it the way I wrote it and I will be really happy.
And you probably have that way you wrote it in your head or no?
No.
You have to go back and look.
I have to actually, and this is another convenience thing, I don't remember. I mean, it's really funny. I've written so many recipes that I remember the spirit of the recipe. I remember the broad strokes, but the minutiae and the details are really what sets a recipe apart. When you're just cooking, you know, you're in your kitchen. And are you a cook?
I am. But this goes into my next question, which is about the sensibility of cooking.
Yeah.
Like how you get a sense of what tastes good with what.
Yes. So, right. So when you know what you love, right? You know the flavor combinations and maybe you're happy to try something new, right? When you're cooking with a recipe. But when I'm doing it, I'll do like this, I'll take this third road sometimes is what if, I know it doesn't sound good, but the what if the road never traveled? Why hasn't anybody done this and this? And maybe it's a really bad idea, but I'm not afraid to take those risks.
Right. And so I ask because, so my main thing, and this sounds like a simple thing, but I get very, very involved are salads, right?
Yes.
I do like roasted vegetables in them and various kinds of cheeses. And, you know, I get kind of creative with it, but sometimes I have to actually Google, does roasted red pepper go with Asiago?
Right, like, right.
But I imagine you know those kinds of things just naturally.
I do have a lot of that stuff in my head, but I'm also not afraid to try. And sometimes the reason that nobody's done it isn't, there's no reason. I mean,
right.
Or sometimes flavor combinations fall out of fashion, you know? I mean, gosh, you know, I remember things that tasted good from my childhood that we just don't do anymore. Like I had a family friend that used to do this. It was one of those cream cheese dips with pineapple and curry powder and currants and like all these weird things. And it was so good. And we just, not to say those flavors aren't good, but they're not fashionable in that combination. So I think it's really important to be able to take risks. And for me, if I fail on a recipe, it's not a big deal because I can quickly whip up something that I know will be good. So one fail means pasta with anchovies and garlic and everybody is happy.
Right.
Or I've, you know what I mean? Right, exactly. It's like my go-to. Or I've created something, you know, that's exciting and new. And that's fine. Even if it's not the best thing in the world, if it's still, you know, interesting and delicious enough, I love to push that envelope. But these recipes are the ones that don't push the envelope. These are the solids. These are the ones that work every single time.
I'm talking with Melissa Clark of the New York Times here with her new book, Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. And there's 100 recipes in here. And these are the ones you said that don't push the envelope. But right. I wanted to also ask, just for my own, are there flavors that you never put together?
Okay, so for a while I thought I'm an anchovy lover.
Same.
Yeah. So one of the things I hadn't done until actually a book that I'm working on right now is anchovies with something sweet. Now, it's not that weird. I mean, in Japanese cuisine, you'll see that a lot, and it's so delicious to get the fish flavor with a little bit of sweetness, but it's not something that I habitually do. But in this latest book next book I'm working on, I did anchovy with baked brie cheese, anchovies, garlic, and honey.
Wow.
And I would never think that would work.
That sounds delicious.
It was so good. And I made it without the honey. And I was eating this sort of runny brie with the funky anchovies and the garlic. And it had a little chili in it too, a little spice. And I thought, you know, it just needs something sweet. And so I just squished some honey on top. And it really took it in this interesting direction where I personally hadn't gone. Not to say other people hadn't gone there. But for me, it was a new thing. And it was really exciting. And that's you know, when I develop recipes, I'm looking to like find the thing, you know, that just
right.
that unexpected, oh.
Right. I would imagine for you, because this is what you do in your livelihood, that you have a fairly sizable kitchen. But another thing that I think about for those of us who sort of dabble and it isn't our thing but love to cook, does it matter with the size of your kitchen?
I mean, it does if you are one of those ambitious people who want to do a dish that, you know, takes a lot of space, or like if you want to make homemade croissants and in your own from scratch, you know, you need space for that. Not to say you can't do it in a small kitchen, it's just harder. You just have to be mentally prepared to move stuff around. My first kitchen in New York was the size, I mean, really, it was the size of a normal closet. It was teeny. Two of us could not stand in it. You could not open the refrigerator and stand at the stove at the same time because the fridge door would hit you.
Right.
So it was very confined. So.
A New York story.
And I had a catering company out of that kitchen. I mean, I just took over the hallway. And just my baking trays were on the floor. I had makeshift tables. So if you love to cook, and you don't even need to do that. If you're just cooking for your family and you have a small kitchen, just if you're going to be ambitious, you plan ahead. Otherwise, you know, create a space in your kitchen that you can work from, even if it means moving things around. Like, here's a good tip for people with small kitchens. Put things on, if you have a lot of tools that you keep sort of on the counters, you know, people have tools in little crocks.
Mm-hmm.
Put all of those crocks on a decorative tray. And then if you need that space, it's instead of moving six things, you move one thing away. And then all of a sudden you have this extra space. And then that tray goes, you know, in the living room on the floor while you're cooking. And it's not such a big deal to create space for yourself. So there are little ways that you can do that. But I really believe that a small kitchen is not an excuse for not cooking.
And what about ingredients? Like, what are the ingredients to always have? Because I think that is also in sort of league with the kitchen, the size of your kitchen. It's like,
yes.
how do you keep certain things that you'll always use?
Well, you should identify, you know, you should identify what those things are that you always do use. Cooking magazines always give you lists, like you always need to have Parmesan and you always need to have lemons and garlic and pasta. But if you don't eat those things, then you shouldn't have them. But who are you? What do you really do? I mean, for you, so if you're always making salads, you know, maybe you always need to have bags of washed greens, you know, at the ready, right? And then you know that a salad is 2 minutes away. Here's a trick, another thing. Instead of having whole lemons, I have lemons and I cut them up into wedges. And I put these wedges in the bowl. So when I make a salad dressing, instead of having to start from a cut lemon, I have the wedges at the ready. So I put my greens in a bowl. The wedges are there. Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. Olive oil, salt, done. And it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it does save every single night. It makes salad that much more accessible.
When you devise a new recipe, aside from the ingredients, what inspires you?
Seasonality is a big thing. You know, not to say I eat strictly seasonally because I don't, but when I do go to the farmer's market every week, and you know, at this point, I go as much for the companionship as I go for the produce. I mean, you know, when you've been going to the same place for years, I mean, I know the farmers. I know a lot of the people there. It's a social experience. So I'm very good. I really get myself to go because it's part of my Saturday routine. And anything that's new, especially in spring, because, you know, you've come out of this winter, and right now, all of a sudden, stuff's new. And so I'm inspired by whatever I have not seen before, or whatever I haven't seen in months.
Like the Bounty.
And if it's so asparagus is now, and it's so exciting. Fiddlehead ferns, which are, right. I don't even like fiddlehead ferns, to be honest.
They're beautiful.
But they're so beautiful, I buy them anyway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as soon as summer comes, I'm going to see, you know, zucchini and eggplant, whatever it is. It's that my biggest inspiration is the first time I see something in season at the market, and then I buy a ton of it. And then, you know, either I'll use it or it'll sit in the fridge for a while.
I'm talking with Melissa Clark, whose new book is Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. And if you have a question for Melissa Clark, you can either give us a call at 212-433-9692 or send us a tweet. Our handle is at WNYC Midday. So I love how this book is like, there are pictures too, which is always, I mean, we were just talking about how seasonal it is and the Bounty and how you have almost a visceral reaction.
Yes.
If you're somebody who cooks. What was that choice and how you worked with the photographer?
Okay, so part of the decision to create this book, so this book is, it's 100 recipes, basically, curated from two of my cookbooks, Cook This Now, which had a few photos, and they were beautiful photos from Andrew Scrivani, who is my collaborator at the Times. Beautiful, but not that many. And then another book that I wrote called In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, which had no photos whatsoever. And so the idea was to create new photos and to illustrate more of them, just illustrate more of the recipes to give people a sense of what the food looks like. It is so important. You know, you really do taste with your eyes first. And when a recipe tempts you, it's often, you know, people make the recipes that have the pictures. I know that if I want to publish a new book, I make sure to take photos of my favorites, because I know those are the ones that people are going to be drawn to first. So for this book, we had Dana Gallagher, who is a fantastic photographer. And she and I, you know, picked the recipes to do. And we really wanted to create a different experience from either of the books from where the recipes came. This book is beautiful. And I feel it's very intimate, because all the photos are, they're just images that you haven't necessarily seen before. So it's another look into the way I cook, and hopefully tempt you to try recipes you maybe haven't tried before.
It's also inspiring, though, too. I mean, I think, artistically speaking, one of the reasons that I'm drawn to salads is that I love for them to be beautiful, like purple cabbage and orange pepper, and you know that really matters to me. And so the photos, I'm sure, also play that role to some extent. People want to create beautiful food.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I really do believe that, and I believe that people are, you can read something and you can't necessarily picture it. And even if you look at a photo and you don't know what you're looking for, you know, just like you said, if you see the colors and you just see this, you know, the crispness or the texture, even if you don't necessarily like it, like, you know, say it's like you're not a fish person and you see this beautiful fish, but you see all these other colors and textures on the plates, maybe it'll tempt you to try that. And that, to me, if a photo can do that, a great photo of food, then that is a great success.
Do you think much about when and where food is served?
You know, at home, I do a lot. I think a lot about where I eat. We have a big kitchen, but the table in the kitchen is really small. So we really do eat in the dining room as often as we can. And we light the candles. You know,
same.
We have...
Same, see, absolutely.
Doesn't it make such an
entire difference? I mean, I light them when I start cooking.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, because I cook in the kitchen and that's where our table is.
And do you have wine when you cook?
I do.
Me too.
I do. That's the ritual. It's to light the candles, pour the glass of wine, start cooking.
It divides. To me, I call it the weekend at the end of every day. You know what I mean? Like, that's the time I turn off, like, I stop checking my email.
Yep.
I'm with my family, and it's a signal to just disconnect, be in the moment, and really sort of enjoy the process of cooking. And the candle and the wine, to me, exactly. I should do that. I should start with the candles
early.
Yeah,
it's nice. It's nice. And do you take the rest, all of the ingredients out? Do you take the plates? I'm like, what is the process there?
You know, it depends on if I am, mostly I don't usually know what I'm making before I start. Like, I have an idea, like, okay, I'm going to have pasta tonight. Or I got chicken or I got some fish. but I don't really know what I'm doing, and I'll change my mind halfway through. Often what I'll do is I'll email my husband in the middle of the day. I'll have an idea for a recipe and I'll email him and say, hey, what do you think about, you know, I got some cod fillets. What do you think? I'll do cod fillets with mushrooms and garlic. And he'll email me. And by the way, we're emailing and we're in the same house. But that's just how we do it. And he'll say, you know, that sounds delicious, but I know that that's not actually what we're going to have for dinner because this is 6 hours earlier. And by the time you get to the stove, it's going to be completely different. And it's true because in those 6 hours, I'll remember that, oh, wait, you know, in the back of the fridge, I have all of those, you know, red chilies that I got that I should really use. And I have capers and, ooh, you know, we could put anchovies in this
dish.
It's
so nice that you have a partner in crime or someone who is as excited about what you're cooking as you are. I'm speaking with Melissa Clark about her newest cookbook, Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen, Family Meals, Festive Gatherings, and Everything in Between. This is Midday on WNYC. This is Rebecca Carroll. I'm talking with Melissa Clark, who has been a staple for lovers of Wednesday's New York Times column, A Good Appetite. She's here to talk about her new book, Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. Welcome back. I would like to talk with you. You mentioned fish before the break.
Yes.
I love fish. I can't figure out how to make it.
Okay, what goes wrong with you? Because I know that you are going to be like all of our listeners, so tell me, what is it, overcooked? Is it undercooked?
So first of all, it's choosing the right fish for texture, right? So I like it to be kind of flaky, but also tender. So I try tilapia or cod or flounder, but it always is... fishy or overcooked or undercooked, all those things.
Okay, so you know the... I would say definitely get the freshest fish. I think more so than looking for a particular kind of fish, go with what is the freshest and just rely on where you're buying your fish. You know, ask them, like, because they know, you know, your fishmonger knows. And, you know, you can say if you like a mild flavor or a slightly more intense flavor. As far as flakiness goes, you know, fish like, I mean, things that we don't necessarily think of like mackerels, if you like a flaky texture and you don't mind a stronger taste, you know, it's those can often be overlooked fish. And so make sure to get the freshest, and that's really going to help in terms of flavor. And in terms of cooking, I would say if you are timing with fish can be tricky, but if the most forgiving way to cook it is slow. You know, we think, oh, we should sear it or broil it, and that's great, but your margin of error, like if you get distracted,
That's what I do.
Yes. So I think go slow. Go for like a confit, like a fish confit, which really, I mean, it sounds super fancy, but really what that means is low oven, lots of olive oil. That's all. So cover your fish with lots of olive oil. You don't need to submerge it, but just really be generous and do a low oven, do 300 or 325, put lots of aromatics. So what are your favorite herbs? Do you love rosemary?
I like rosemary, though it feels a little heavy to me sometimes. You know, I'm mostly a garlic, lemon, olive oil.
That's enough.
I haven't figured out the herb that I like the best.
Okay, so that's plenty. You know what? If you know those are the flavors, do you like olives?
Love.
Or tomatoes? So, you know, those are the kinds of things you can add. And just start there. Here's some tips, though. When you get your fish fillet, season the fillet first before you do anything else on both sides, before it goes into the pan. I think sometimes we forget and we put the fish in the pan and then try to season it, and then we don't season the other side. And then, you know, or it's going to slide right off when the olive oil goes on. So season it first and just give it a beat. Like,
I just want to back up for a minute because you mentioned your fishmonger will know.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't have a fishmonger.
I know. It's like I was thinking that.
And also when you were talking about mackerel, you know, of course, I come from the country where, you know, we had fresh trout. We had fresh mackerel and bass.
Perfect.
And all that kind of thing. But I don't live in the country. I live in the city and I don't have a fishmonger.
Right.
I mean, certainly you could go to Whole Foods or you could go to, but if you're just going to a grocery store, how do you buy fish?
Yeah. See, this is generally, there is somebody there who knows, but they may not want to talk to you. Like, they're behind, you know, because somebody's packaging up those fish.
Right.
If you're a fish lover, it is really worth going and making that connection. It's just worth it. You know, they, even if they're, I know that I do this at my supermarket all the time. I don't buy a lot of fish at the supermarket, but I buy meat at the supermarket and I make the connection with the butchers and they're in there, they're in the back.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of knock on the, you know, never buy fish on sale. That's right. Because if it's at the supermarket and if it's on sale, they are trying to get rid of it for the most part. That's my that's just my prejudice. That might be totally wrong, but I would say if you're worried about it. And then also, do you ever go to a farmer's market?
Yep.
Because there's, you know, there's usually a fish person at the farmer's market.
And then I feel all this pressure. Like I get this beautiful fish and I'm like, don't mess it up.
Don't mess it. But then low and slow. And see, that's, you're not going to mess it up low and slow. It's really the high heat. It's that searing that does it. It's that like broiling. And that is a great flavor, but maybe that's like fish 2.0. You know, maybe fish... Maybe fish 1.0 is low and slow, your favorite, salt it first, wait 5 minutes, put it in the pan, put your garlic on it, put your lemon slices or lemon juice on it, some olive oil, and just 325. And herbs, if you can, you know, a mild herb that you might like, thyme is on the mild, and don't use that much, just a few little, you know, a few little leaves sprinkled on top, very delicate, some pepper. If you like spice, you can add a little cayenne. Then add the olives, add the tomatoes, but think low, slow, and then you can keep checking it. You know, just keep poking at it. Fish doesn't mind. It's you know, it's your dinner. It's dead. Yeah. You know?
So then the other thing is, in terms of herbs, what's the over-under with dried versus fresh?
Okay. So if you have really good dried herbs, like I always tell people, if it doesn't taste good, if a spice or it doesn't taste good, or if you have an herb and you're adding it and you're thinking this dish needs a lot more flavor, but I added the right amount of spices or herbs, it's probably because it's been in your cabinet for, you know, 5 years. I know that my mother has stuff in the back of her cabinet that I remember from my childhood. Every once in a while I go and pull stuff out and throw it out when she's not looking. So probably there's probably stuff in your spice cabinet that needs to go. Do a clean, you're going to be so much happier. And then just buy the few that you use that you keep using. So if you love, say, dried thyme or dried dill, you know, keep using it and then you'll be able to turn it over. Another thing to do is, and this might sound annoying, but it's really not. Just give me a minute with this. So buy a bunch of fresh herbs, like a branchy herb. So rosemary works well. Thyme works well, oregano or marjoram. And you know how when you buy a bunch of herbs, you don't really finish it? I know that I don't usually finish it before it starts to get brown.
The fresh ones.
Right,
right,
the fresh
exactly.
ones.
That's my question.
Yeah. So tie them up, just little string, and just stick them on a hook or somewhere, or just put them anywhere in your kitchen that you're not going to worry about them, and dry them yourself. I know it sounds fussy, but it's not. And then you just crumble them into a little jar, and they have so much amazing flavor. So I know it sounds like, okay, I'm never, ever going to do that. But I swear, one little bunch of thyme, tie it up with, don't even use a string. Just use one of those like little supermarket twist tie things from your bread and just, you don't even need to get string. And just hang it somewhere and let it dry out. And then you're going to see when you put it in a jar, you're going to say, oh, wow, this is what it should taste like.
I'm talking with Melissa Clark, whose new book is Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. We have a tweeter. Lizzie on Twitter says, love Melissa Clark's sheet pan recipes. Does she have any new ones in her latest book? Also looking for fish recipes don't smell up a small, poorly ventilated New York City kitchen.
Okay, so, well, first of all, the book doesn't have new recipes. It's a compilation of old recipes, but maybe there are recipes that she hasn't seen before, and it does have some sheet pan stuff in there. I love a sheet pan dinner. It's so convenient. I love fish on a sheet pan, especially because here's another thing. Fish smells so much more when you cook it on top of the stove than when you do in the oven. It really does. So that low and slow thing in the oven that I was talking about, that works great for keeping the fishy smell out of your kitchen.
I am talking with Melissa Clark, whose new cookbook is Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. So we just had a Twitter person ask about fish and the smell of fish and the size of the kitchen and if that matters and all those kinds of things, which... It does sort of come into play. This Twitter person.
What do
also,
we say? Tweet? What's the right
tweet
word?
Person, tweet people. Said that she loved your sheet recipes. Yeah. And you said you love a sheet dinner.
Yeah, what sheet is pan that? Dinner, yeah.
What is that?
Okay, so a sheet pan is, it's just a big baking pan that's very large and has low sides. So not like a 9 by 13 brownie pan. you know, or like a roasting pan, but just like, and not a cookie sheet, because cookie sheets don't have any sides at all. But it's, so it's just, imagine a pan that's like a cookie sheet, but has a little, has rims. You probably have one of these pans. You probably use it all the time and you're just not thinking about what it's called. You're, it's just a pan. Okay. But we've been calling it, you know, it's sort of the new way to describe multiple items cooked on this pan at the same time is a sheet pan supper. And the idea is that you cook everything in the oven in one place at the same time. It's like a one pot meal, but instead of on the stove, you're doing it in the oven. And what's wonderful about that is that it's, you get the texture. You know, when you're cooking something in a one pot meal, really it's soft and braised, and soft is the predominant texture. But with a sheet pan dinner, you get crunchy, you get crispy, you get caramelized, you get all these.
Okay, spill. Best one.
Best one. Okay, my favorite one. And it is not in this cookbook. In fact, it's online at the New York Times, and you can, anyone can find it. It's a, called, it's a harissa chicken with leeks and potatoes. So imagine crispy potatoes, crispy chicken, and crispy leeks all together on the same pan. And then you put yogurt on top of it, and it's really good. So that would be my favorite. I also have a, I love chicken on a sheet pan. Chicken, because crispy skin chicken. It's just, it works really well. And especially chicken parts, you can do the whole thing in 30 minutes. It's a weekday dinner. I have one with sweet potatoes. And I have, gosh, there's a bunch. If you put in, any search engine, if you put in sheet pan supper, you'll see a lot of options. And I know that some of, fish and a sheet, I have a, you said you liked red peppers, right, Rebecca?
Yes.
So red peppers and black sea bass and olives on a sheet pan in the oven at the same time. The peppers get soft and they, you know, almost like a roasted red pepper, but with the skin on still.
So this is opening a whole new world
for me. I'm so excited. This is good. I'm so glad we're talking about sheet pans. My favorite topic, really. And then the olives and some sage, some fresh sage, or you can use oregano, whatever fresh herb, and then a fish fillet. And it is a 20-minute dinner.
Tell us about the two recipes that we have posted on our show page at WMYC.org/midday, the crushed new potato and pea salad.
Yes. Okay. So this is an exciting thing. You know how we always think those little red potatoes in the supermarket are new potatoes?
Yeah.
Like they call them new potatoes. Mm-hmm. They're not new potatoes necessarily. They're just old potatoes that are small. So people think they're babies, but they're not. But this time of year, starting in about a month from now, in late June, early July, we get real new potatoes, like potatoes that are actually just dug out of the ground. And you think, well, I get potatoes all year long. Why do I care?
They're little,
yep. But they're so much tastier. It actually, there is such a thing as a real new potato, and it is an absolutely delicious thing. And we just don't think of it because we think of potatoes as being the all-year thing. But you know what? There's a time when they're new and we should seek them out. And so I created this salad to take advantage of new potatoes, and then peas are out. So peas also come end of June, beginning of July, and the potatoes and the peas are in season at the same time. And this salad uses them with a yogurt dressing with mustard seeds. And mustard seeds, to bring out their flavor, you want to put them in a hot pan just for a minute until they sort of pop. And it releases their flavor. You put them in the yogurt. You've got garlic and lemon juice. And it's a creamy salad with these amazing potatoes. And by the way, this will work with any, but you can use old potatoes for the salad. It's fine. I mean, but the inspiration behind this was seeing these peas and then these little new potatoes out at the same time in the farmer's market. And I thought, well, not only are they in season together, I could boil the potatoes and then in the same pot, I could throw the peas in. I don't even have to use another
fresh
pot.
Fresh peas are so delicious.
Fresh peas are so delicious. I have made the salad in the dead of winter with old potatoes and frozen peas, and it's still really good. But, you know, the thing that got me excited was the newness. But it's a good, and the flavors are good because you've got the tangy yogurt, you have the spiciness of the mustard seeds, and then, of course, who doesn't love a potato salad?
Listening to you describe your recipes, of course, it's clear that you like your own cooking.
I do
like
my own cooking.
And so it's funny, my 12-year-old son, you know, whenever we don't go out to dinner very often, and the reason is, as my 12-year-old will tell you, is because mom never likes anybody else's restaurant's cooking. Like, if it's not as good as what I can make myself, why would I pay?
Well, I mean, that is, yes, I understand that feeling really well. You know, it's like, because no one knows what you like as well as you. So,
right.
Of course, you like your own cooking. If you love to cook and you love to eat, you know how to
and
make yourself
happy. And I know what's in it.
And you know what's in it, and you feel good about it. And I think that's such, I mean, I'm really, I want people to do that more. I want them to get to know themselves and get to know some simple techniques and cook more, because you're going to be happier. You're going to spend less money. You're going to use better ingredients. You're going to be healthier. And then, yes, go out and splurge and have an amazing meal. Go to a place that cooks food that you're
right.
not, that you
that
wouldn't
you don't make.
That's exactly.
Exactly.
You yeah. know, yeah, yeah, that's yeah. the trick.
Yep. We also have, which is really interesting to me because I can never seem to get this right, Merguez burgers. Yeah.
Okay. So merguez are a type of lamb sausage from North Africa that are spicy, and they've got fennel and coriander seed and chili, and they're just this amazing sausage. Now, I throw those on the grill when I can get them, but what if you can't get one? Get them, right?
Right.
So this, instead, it uses ground lamb, and it has all the same flavors that go in a merguez sausage, except it's in a burger patty. So ground lamb, and then those same spices, and a lamb burger is it's such a good thing because it's got a fuller flavor than beef. It's very lean, but because it has such a rich flavor, you don't notice that it's lean. And then,
that too matters what kind you get with the quality of it.
Yeah, but you know the thing about lamb is that you know how you can get bad ground beef, like beef that's been on the feed. It's hard to get bad ground lamb because it's not like you can really find a lot of ground lamb. You have to seek it out. Pretty much you have to go to a butcher or Whole Foods or a big supermarket, and for the most part they're not using, you know, lamb lambs are not raised in the same way as beef, so it's a little, you can feel better about buying ground lamb and not feel like, and it's expensive. I mean, you pay for it. It's not mm-hmm. you know, it's not, you're not going to get like the $6.99 a pound bargain ground meat like you would with beef, but it really has such a rich, delicious flavor, and I don't think that we think of ground lamb as something to buy or something to make a burger out of necessarily.
But I think also, and this is, you know, me saying that there is bad lamb, right?
It's right.
Clearly, I haven't made it right if I'm saying that there's bad. But you can't make lamb burgers without some kind of seasoning. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you could actually. You could just do, I mean, if you're a burger minimalist and you just like your beef burgers, and you have to love lamb. I mean, you have to be like the kind of person who's just anything lamby. I have made salt pepper lamb burgers. So, and I do this with beef too. If you get really good quality lamb and you get really, you know, a good hot grill with maybe it's like a good, just you need enough heat. You know, sometimes gas grills don't give you enough heat and you don't get the char. So you have the lamb flavor, which is heightened by the salt and the pepper, and then you have the char. So that's the other important flavor. That's what you need to have mm-hmm. sort of a naked lamb burger. But if maybe you're just pan frying it, you're just broiling it, you just want a delicious spicy burger, then add, you know, that's when spices are your friends and you don't necessarily need to have that charred element because you've got so much else going on.
All right, I have to try them again though, because I have tried several times to make a very good lamb burger and it...
You know what? If you like beef, you can use beef for this. I mean, it's absolutely fine.
I love lamb when it's cooked well. I just haven't mastered it. It's like a good pork chop, right?
Pork chops are hard.
Yeah.
Pork chops are really hard because most of the pork we get is not fatty enough. So there's no internal fat, and then they come out kind of chewy.
Yeah.
And the thing with lamb is that, I don't know, I think try cooking it slightly less. Maybe, are you okay with rare?
Yeah.
Okay. So go on the even rarer side. I think maybe overcooked lamb can be gamey.
That's right.
Is that what's going on? Okay.
Exactly,
so cook it even less than you think.
Okay. So when you yourself, you mentioned earlier about magazines giving lists and so on and so forth, look through magazines with recipes, what makes you pay attention to something?
Well, I mean, I'm always reading magazines to find out what other people are doing to get inspired. I mean, I love seeing different combinations that I hadn't thought of. But I also love to see, you know, when sometimes I'll buy magazines that are more mainstream than the stuff I do, just to see, like, what's entered the mainstream, mm-hmm. you know? And I was thrilled. I was reading a supermarket magazine, and there was Radicchio. I was like, yes, Radicchio in the supermarket. And that just makes, so I love to kind of see what's going on. And that means that, Radicchio has made it in, you know?
It had a moment.
But it wasn't like a mainstream America moment. It was a urban American moment. And to see it in like a very mainstream, you know, middle of America magazine, I live in New York, you know? It's like I have to remember that not everybody can get what I can get. Not everybody has the same ingredients. And not to say not everyone can cook, because, you know, of course, good food is available no matter where you are in this country. You can get great food, but what are you getting, you know, and what just to see like where we're at in terms of culinary culture across the entire country.
Melissa Clark is the author of Favorite Recipes from Melissa Clark's Kitchen. It's a book of 100 of her go-to recipes in one book for Black Dog and Leventhal publishers. I'm so delighted that you've come. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.